Hey, this is Ed. So this is a podcast, is that right?
This is.
Okay. We're officially podcasting right now. That's awesome.
This is Straight from the Cutter's Mouth.
Welcome to Straight from the Cutter's Mouth, a retina podcast. At least once a week, we aim to bring you insights and perspectives from the world of vitreoretinal surgery. I'm your host, Dr. Jay Schreather. Today, on episode 397, we bring you the preview of the July-August edition of Retinal Physician. As a reminder, Retinal Physician can be found online at retinalphysician.com and in print as well for free. We have articles covering several topics in ophthalmology, and a really hot topic, again, is cost and availability of drugs. We talk about pharmaceutical shortages and how they apply to ophthalmology and to retina. We also discuss anesthesia for retinal surgery and the different options, including subtenons and topical anesthesia. We talk about management for retinal detachment in the setting of high myopia, and end with the discussion of advances in training for vitreoretinal surgery in the new digital era. As always, you can find a list of financial disclosures in the episode description. And if you want to claim CME credits for older episodes, you can click on the link in the episode description. That will take you to the American Academy of Ophthalmology website to claim those credits. Straight from the Cutter's Mouth is now back with a preview of the July 2023 edition of Retinal Physician. Remember, Retinal Physician is available online and in print for free. You can find it at retinalphysician.com. And we do these previews where we use the articles as jumping off points for discussion. And if you want to read the full articles, you can always find them on the website. And for this preview, I got three of my friends and colleagues joining me in alphabetical order. First, Dr. Lediana Goduni, who's in Cleveland.
Hi, good to be back.
Dr. Mari Rodriguez, who is in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Hi, Jay. Thank you for having me.
No problem. It's pronounced Worcester, not Worcester, is what I've learned over time.
And
Dr. Josh Weir, who is in the Jersey Shore, but in Philadelphia as well. And so he knows all about names that don't sound the way they're spelled. So Josh, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Bala Kinwood, King of Prussia.
Google, Bryn Mawr.
Conchahawken. Yeah, Conchahawken's a good one. Bryn Mawr. Okay. On topic. So we got these articles. We're going to start with this first article, which is called Managing Drug Shortages in Retina Care, with the subtitle Best Practices Can Mitigate Gaps in Drug Availability. Roger Goldberg and George McGrath wrote this up. And again, just to summarize their big take-home points, they talk that the FDA actually keeps track of shortages. And ophthalmology has had many recent shortages due to supply chain issues in the last couple of years. And that's actually a good resource to the FDA to kind of see where those shortages are. And some of the problems with this, you know, obviously it results in issues in terms of delivering care to patients. And they talk about sort of the ways that this is presented. There's a little discussion of triesence was in a shortage, fluorescein, still some issues we can talk about now. Bisudine or verdiporfin for PDT has had shortages. And Avastin, there was a shortage a few years ago, actually, and there's had problems periodically where compounding pharmacies stopped releasing batches on schedule due to sterility issues. And then you end up with these shortages that have trickle down effects. And of course, there's other issues with Avastin, including silicone oil. And then there's other drops, you know, some of these drops, Polytrim right now is on the discontinued list, which was news to me. I haven't prescribed it in a long time, but that's actually very good to file away. Interferon drops under, again, a discontinuation. And again, they talk a little bit about why this happens. Part of it is the manufacturing, part of it is the compounding part. And then they get into, so what do you do, right? Some solutions include, right, you can try to find a substitute. That's a good one. And they give some examples, for example, for Kenalog instead of triesence, although we can talk again about how you can do that if there's some issues with that. Try to use as small as possible to kind of maximize your doses and so you don't run into those shortages. And then the biggest issue is sort of clinical trials, because if you're in a trial and you're trying to enroll people, then you are going to get into trouble because you're not going to be able to follow the trial criteria. And that's a big issue. So I thought, Josh, I'll start with you. I thought this is an interesting sort of concept. I think there's a lot of discussion about this. We just did, we have a podcast coming up talking about, for example, fluorescein, and there's major issues with fluorescein. Like in your day-to-day practice, what's the, is that the biggest one for you guys around is fluorescein? Is there anything else that you guys are sort of encountering?
Fluorescein is a big one. The other one is triesence. I know you just mentioned that it was recently on backorder. We still don't have it. I'm curious if you guys do, but triazines and fluorescein are two biggest shortages, challenges in terms of drug shortages currently.
Mari, how about you?
The biggest one for me is triazines, both in the OR and in clinic. It's been quite disruptive. You know, so I've had to change some of my practice based on that shortage. And also the Bisoudine, that was also a big one. And, you know, I had to stop some PDTs that I had planned. But I haven't been really hit by the fluorescein shortage up here.
Lidiana?
Yeah, definitely. We don't have triazines. Fluorescein, you know, we got the email when the news came out that Akron Pharmaceuticals was closing. So since then, at least since then, I'm not sure if this was being done prior, we've been using 2.5 mLs and 5-minute FA times, mm-hmm. instead of, unless the physician asks for 10 minutes to use the full dose. My practice as a whole group, we had been using ofloxacin as a post-op drop. And recently that's, you know, we have, like, we're getting calls back from the pharmacy saying they don't have it. So that's also not really available anymore. So we kind of had to figure out as a group what kind of drop we would adopt. And interestingly, Akron Pharmaceuticals was one of the larger producers of ofloxacin as well. So that's probably one of the reasons, mm-hmm. You know, that's also difficult to get now. Allergan and Bausch Health and some other companies were making it, and they haven't really said, I think, why it's on, you know, shortage for them, but for Akron, obviously closed. So those are like the bigger ones that are affecting our practice currently.
You know, Mari and Josh, Lediana's trying to really, really subconsciously and subliminally insert Ohio references into this podcast by calling the company
Akron. It's not even in Ohio. I actually think it's in Illinois.
But actually, the company is Acorn. I'm getting in touch with my inner squirrel. But she wants us all to go to Akron.
Oh, my God. Is it? Acorn?
It's Acorn, yeah. But you may be reading it as Akron because of the map.
In my mind, I read it as Akron.
I mean, now you're making me question myself. Now...
No, I think it's Acorn.
Who's gaslighting right now? Wait a second. Let me see. It is
but
Acorn.
But it's actually in Illinois. I know it's in Illinois. I don't know why I even said that.
Yeah. No, Akron's got to be in Ohio. Acorn's got to be in Illinois. Triazines is something that's interesting because I used a decent amount of it in clinical practice and I used it a lot in surgery. And I think there's kind of different questions that come up with that shortage. And we had a short period where we were able to compound it, and we're very spoiled because we have our own compounding pharmacy. But, you know, I kind of switched over to using Kenalog for surgery, and I will always sort of maintain that it's different. It's not inferior, but it's definitely different from marking the vitreous in terms of the size of the particles. But now I think I've fully adjusted at this point and I'm over it. In the clinic, though, it gets harder to use Kenalog as a sub, and they talk a little bit about, like, you can use it subtenons or subcons, but intravitreal. The funny thing is I used to Kenalog intravitreal all the time at one point, but because you have this issue of reaction to the preservative, there is actually a black box warning to say not designed for intraocular use. So you should not use it as a sub. The problem is sometimes it's harder. Even the insurances kind of get caught in the middle because they don't want to improve an Ozurdex, for example, because it's much more expensive. So it ends up being a little tug of war. Fluorescein, we just got an email. Bascom, there was an email sent to all the faculty recently that there is, again, a shortage of it. And like you said, Acorn's not manufacturing it. Alcon is still. And there's two major issues. One is they're not able to keep up yet with the amount of demand, right? You cut off one of the major suppliers. But the second issue is it's more expensive from where they sell it from. And one of the articles I'm going to cover in a journal club coming up is there was an article published by Avni Finn and co-authors where they talk about how if you do the math, practices actually are going to lose money in a lot of states doing FAs because fluorescein is expensive unless you start stretching your fluorescein, right? Which is people are doing that not for the money component, but you guys reference you're doing it to sort of be able to get FA, especially for diabetics, Mari. I feel like we've gotten really spoiled, but it's good. If you have an Optos available, it's really powerful to have a wide field FA. And I feel like FA went through, like, in the 90s, everyone with an AMD got an FA pre-anti-VEGF. And then in the 2000s, late 2000s, FA started dropping off because people stopped getting FAs in their AMD patients. But now, because of wide field Optos and other wide field photography, people are starting to get more and more and more FAs. I think FAs have probably been on the rise, but now it's interesting that if you don't have access to the chemical substance, then maybe the next push, Mari, will be for, like, wide field OCTA or something like that as a sub. If down the line, if this remains still a shortage.
No, I agree. I think, you know, you kind of have to adapt. Otherwise, you know, what are you going to do? You're going to sink, right? And I think sometimes, you know, this thing's going to make you think outside the box, and it may end up being good for patient care in the long run. You know, we may end up not having to use so many FAs anyway in these diabetics, and still, you know, find those little small little front dye of neovascularization. I find that just, you know, optos without the FA, I'm able to pick up a lot of things.
Our ability to assess diabetic retinopathy is not as good as an optos or an optos FA. I think that's true for all of us. I think the real question that will come up, and the old school people say, does it clinically matter? But I think I'm starting to think we're going to get more and more data that does matter. So then we have to have fixes. You know, the other interesting point here, and I don't know, do any of you guys do trials in your practices? Lidiana does. So like, I didn't even think about the shortages in the context of a trial.
We do.
And Mara, you guys do. So like, maybe Lidiana first, like comment, like in terms of a trial, like that's a real issue, right? Because if you're halfway through a trial and all of a sudden you don't have enough drug, let's say it's a triessence. I don't know if a trial is out there, but let's say triessence was the control in a trial and all of a sudden it's not in stock. That whole trial has to suspend, and like if that data is going to be very, very messy. So have you guys discussed this from a research perspective? Because this was actually, I had never even thought about this. I feel like I think about retina a lot, probably more than I should. And then I hadn't even thought about this part of it until I read what they wrote about that. That's like a very good point.
It hasn't come up like since I've been here, but maybe that has been a discussion in the past. But I think that the trials that are undergoing recently are not, I guess, at risk of any medication shortages. It hasn't come up, but I'm sure that would be very disruptive, obviously.
Mari, any thoughts on your side? Or have you guys talked about it?
I guess like the FA is a concern, because you know, a lot of these trials, you need to get baseline FAs, and even for training for some of our technicians to be qualified to some of the trials, you need it. So that's something that we're kind of bracing.
You know, let's transition from that discussion. The next article is about anesthesia for retinal surgery. The subtitle, provide the greatest amount of comfort that still ensures an optimal surgical outcome. The subtitles are always so good for these. Just like, I feel like I could not write that subtitle without GPT-4 helping me. But Omar Taboon and Nedan Chowdhury wrote this. And so they talk about different types of anesthesia. It's a good review of subtenons blocks, peribulbar blocks, retrobulbar blocks, and then topical anesthesia. And it's interesting that I would say one of the take homes of this is we can have a discussion about topical anesthesia because this has been reported and published about, and then general. And then, you know, this is just a nice little review of all the different ways to do this. The reason I think it ties into the shortage issue, we can talk again after this about different types of anesthesia, Josh, is there is also sort of a push, and we've talked about that in multiple settings before, to I've heard of friends out in practice or institutions where they're trying to minimize anesthesiologists, switch to CRNAs, get the physician who's the ophthalmologist to be the supervising doctor for the CRNA so they don't have to hire an anesthesiologist, sort of transition to more and more limited anesthesia, especially for quote unquote easier elective cases. And again, and when people are publishing on topical anesthesia, and we have cataract surgeons who are able to do cataract surgery with topical anesthesia, like at an oral Valium in their surgical center, like it seems somewhat reasonable. I'm always just a little queasy because I think retinal surgery, the problem is it can transition very quickly from something very easy to something difficult. And it's one thing to transition from topical to a subtenons during cases. Another thing not to have any sedation on board if someone qualified. Any thoughts on this? I mean, did anyone in your practice do topical? Is something that you thought about topical? Have you ever woken up one day and be like, you know what? I'm going to do topical anesthesia today.
No, I have not. And in fact, when I was reading this, one of the things that came to mind is sometimes I do a subtenons block. So, you know, prep the patient, do a cut down and blunt dissection and then a subtenons. And if I put the trocars in too quickly after that, they feel it. And obviously they had topical before I even do the prep and stuff. So I was a little surprised to hear or to read this discussion on topical. I wasn't aware that people were doing that for vitrectomies. And like you said, things can go south quickly or things can change quickly. So I haven't thought about it. And I'm surprised that patients are able to tolerate it. You know, one workaround, the benefit of topical that they're arguing for is that it's safer. You don't have the risk of a regional block. But if you just do subconjunctival, I would imagine that even that is
a cut down,
or subconj, right. Even anteriorly, I would think that that's probably a lot more comfortable than topical.
Yeah, I was going to ask, I know, Lady Anna, you've transitioned to doing a lot of subtenons in your practice. And like, again, people can have different discussions about there's pros and cons, and we can mention some of those pros and cons now to each one. But I feel, again, if you're I just don't see the advantage of topical over septinons. The only advantage would be, again, we just talked about drug shortages. Like, if you were ever in a situation where, you know, lidocaine and Marcan, I think there was a point that Marcan was on back order a couple of years ago, and we were using lidocaine for everything. Like, if you had no topical anesthetic available that you can inject, but even then you could draw up the topical anesthetic into a syringe and still give it as a subtenon. So you have to have a shortage of like scissors and a cannula. Like, so I just don't see where the disadvantage is beyond subconcheme and a little conge laceration that's going to heal in a day or two. And again, there's the discomfort aspect of it, right? So if you don't have sedation on board, then of course they're going to feel that block versus topical, they don't feel it. But how's your transition been to full-time subtenons? Like, what was the learning curve, and like, what do you view as the pros and cons?
Yeah, so I love doing subtenons. I rarely do retro or peribulbar. I pretty much only do it if like there's a reason, like patient has a skull buckle or something where I can't do a cut down. But it was more so for like the staff there, because all of my other partners, they either do peri or retro. So they were just like very kind of like, you know, I just had to repeat kind of like what I wanted to do for the first couple of weeks for them to like, you know, get used to my steps. But I do, as soon as the patient gets in the room, I do a topical anesthesia and a drop of betadine. And then by the time they get adjusted in the bed and, you know, they're all lined up, then I do subconj, the same block that I give subtenons, I give that subconj. So I put a 30 gauge half inch needle, I give that. And then the patient gets prepped and draped. So in that time, the subconj anesthesia kind of diffuses all around. And then when the patient's all prepped and draped, I do a cut down and I give the rest of that block subtenon. And like you guys were saying, I actually think subconjunctival anesthesia is just fine, because obviously by the time that I put the trocars in, it's only been like a few seconds since I gave the subtenons, but no one has complained of pain with the trocar cannula insertion. And then by the time that we get to, you know, the other parts of the surgery or scleral depression or things like that, then the subtenons block has become effective and it's very comfortable. You know, the patients have been just fine. And I read a lot of papers on this before I kind of transitioned myself. And there's even been like a prospective clinical study that was published in BMC Ophthalmology in 2022. Granted, they only had 60 patients in each group, but they showed that subtenons was just as effective, even more effective in, you know, pain control intraoperatively and postoperatively. So I think if you're, you know, and joining a group where people aren't used to it, it's just a little bit of a learning curve for the staff initially, but then it's like smooth sailing after that. And I love doing subtenons. I don't get, you know, I don't get the anxiety that I would otherwise with retrobulbar. And, you know, a lot of patients are older, they're on blood thinners, myopes, and I just feel like I feel so much more at ease doing subtenons.
Yeah, there's definite, again, part of it has to be technique related, but there are definitely scenarios where it's higher risk to stick a needle into the orbit. And, you know, I've unfortunately seen over, you know, many years of tertiary referrals, and I've seen three different cases where I've had to repair the RD post block perf. In all three scenarios, the eye was pretty long eye. And then, you know, there's people describe techniques. You can do like a bedside subtenons. Like, we have these high-tech anesthesiologists, PASCM, they use an ultrasound. They do a bedside cut down with the cannula. So they do it outside and holding. But I don't think most people are that spoiled. And I think very few, I would say if you did, and they've done some sort of surveys, Mari, about this, most ophthalmologists aren't the ones blocking. It's not anesthesia that's blocking. So then if you're able to block, and go either way. I mean, Mari, I don't know what you're doing in your practice. I think the reasons that people sometimes don't like doing subtenons is they don't get the same proptosis before draping. So sometimes it's a little harder to get the lashes out of the way if the patient's squeezing. Sometimes you have to retract the lashes with like a sticky Tegaderm or something like that after you block. And then, you know, there is a learning curve in the sense if you're not in the right space, then you won't get that nice block in proptosis. And I think it's not that hard to learn, but that's no different, I think, than doing a block out with a needle. But Mari, what's your practice pattern? And is anyone in your practice doing subtenons routinely?
Yeah. So basically what I like to do is do a peribulbar block first. And then, I never do retrobulbar. I think that's, I don't feel comfortable with that. Generally, I've seen only one case as a fellow where there was a perf, and that was one too much for me. And, you know, it was an anesthesiologist that was well-trained. And, you know, after that, I was like, you know, I do all my blocks myself and I do peri. And then after that, I usually have to do a little subtenons to enhance. that's what I do.
Well, speaking of long eyes, the next article was written about repairing detachments in high myopia. There's a Cassie Ludwig and Darius Mashbegi out of Stanford. Great subtitle. Again, expand your surgical toolkit to recover vision and long eyes. I'm jealous if I was writing these subtitles. So they talk a little bit about the epidemiology. And again, you can go and read about that. I would say big take home points. I think that there's just certain considerations you have to have in advance. It's hard because we don't routinely get axial length. So it's more about, I think, the pattern recognition of knowing when the axial length may be longer and you may want to know what it is, or at least get some idea. It's easier if they're pseudophakic, if you can somehow track down their IOL counts, but just, you know, looking for a staphyloma, looking for sort of that, the on the OCT, that staphylomatous appearance is helpful too. And then start planning ahead, especially if you have a macular hole or a myopic mac hole, to have some extra forceps, understand how you can reach. They have the different lens for all the different forceps here, which is a nice little guide probably to stack away and take a little picture and a note of. And I would suggest doing that for folks out there. And then they also talk about hypotony, which is a real issue for myopic eyes, and the higher chance you're going to probably have to suture your sclerotomies to avoid that. And then the vitreous base and how it behaves is very, very different in these eyes. They talk a little bit about different approaches to macular hole retinal detachment. Macular buckling, they talk very, very briefly about, but interestingly enough, I didn't know that there was no commercially available macular buckle, although there are three different options in Europe. And then I think it's important to sort of think about, for foveoschisis, they talk about parafoveal and perifoveal peeling, but the fovea-sparing peel is really, really important in these eyes because it avoids an iatrogenic hole creation. So let's talk about high myopes. I feel, Lidiana, like I still, when I see someone who is highly myopic, my first thing is I really hope they never need to have surgery. My second thing is, oh, maybe you don't need to have surgery. And my third thing is, okay, you definitely have to have surgery because you have a detachment or a progressive hole in schisis that's starting to impair vision. But I think one of the things that that wasn't necessarily emphasized here, and they did a great job covering, was just besides the vitreous base being a posterior, there is this higher incidence of vitreoschisis. And I think that this is one of the things that's tricky, is these eyes can have multiple levels of vitreous similar to a diabetic. And then the other thing is, no one ever talks about this. They always just say like, oh, peel the ILM and just do fovea sparing peel. ILM is really hard to peel in these eyes. Besides the mechanics of it, I just feel like it's very friable. The retina is very thin. It's very difficult to get a continuous flap, and the forces are working against you. It wants to amputate. It doesn't necessarily want to go down the slope towards the hole. So any pearls or tricks you've picked up on how to handle these cases?
I think this paper goes through a lot of them, but I think one of the things that I always do with, especially high myopsis, stay in the vitreous. And you're one of the people that taught me a lot about this, is the, you know, staining and making sure that you really have a PVD, because, you know, in these cases, like they go through the paper, every step kind of builds, upon each other. So, you know, you have to really, if you haven't achieved, you know, an actual PVD, you know, the surgery will fail. So I think that just be conservative. And even if you think that there's a PVD, like you said, a lot of times there might not be in these high myopes. So I always just stain to make sure. Also for postoperative hypotony in high myopes, I also tend to suture as well, just because that way I can also sleep easy at night. And, you know, planning every step in the surgery, like if I know for sure I'm going to suture, I'm not going to displace conge, because that's going to make suturing the sclerotomy is kind of annoying at the end, where you have to find your sclerotomy and stuff. So just thinking about every step ahead of time, just to make your life easier. And then in terms of peeling, I've had a couple of these macular hole RDs, and they're difficult. I think you have to be patient. You have to know what instrument you're comfortable with. Hopefully you've had time to adjust to whatever, you know, instruments there are in your practice prior to having one of these cases, because, you know, it's difficult to do one of these cases having used that kind of forceps for your first time, but just, you know, being really comfortable with the instrumentation already. I think that, like you said, the ILM in these cases is very friable, and I feel like it's a little more difficult to do just pinch and peel, which is what I usually do for cases. So the flex loop has been really helpful for me, even if like it's, you know, kind of coming up in like little pieces, it's helpful to get the flex loop and just like get an edge every time and just kind of, you know, peel the, you know, the ILM that way. So those are the kind of things that I've done in these cases.
And just to be clear, Lidiana has no financial disclosures for Alcon. In fact, she uses a Dork machine.
Yeah, I don't.
So, Mari, any other things to add on in terms of dealing with these high myopes? I mean, how about the counseling part of it too? We can talk about that. Like, what do you tell them heading into the surgery?
Yeah, I spend a lot of time talking to these patients. I think expectations going into surgery is very important. I had one patient that I can think of in the last 6 months. This younger lady with a full thickness macular hole. You know, I had to have one of those special longer island forceps, which was much more difficult to use than the regular one. But you know, she actually ended up closing the hole, but her vision didn't improve at all. Mm. And you know, so that was like a conversation that we had extensively before. Wasn't really upset at the outcome at the end. You know, she kind of understood that this was more of like, you know, let's just see if we can stop the progression rather than make things better. So having, you know, being very frank and open, that's very important, I think, in my book.
Great points. Josh, anything else to add about these cases?
Yeah, just in terms of the expectation conversation, I think it's also important to emphasize without scaring them that their pathology is related to their myopia. So you can do your surgery and you can fix the problem, but they're still at risk for recurrent detachment. They're at risk in the other eye, assuming they're, you know, myopic in both eyes. And so I do emphasize that as well. And to Lidiana's point about staining, the other thing is, especially if you're using, you know, tissue blue or brilliant blue, stain again and again. So not just with the vitreous and triessence or Kenalog, but with the actual brilliant blue, because the ILM can also be hard to visualize in these patients.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think the other things that just to add is if you're going to put a tamponade, is always remember that you're much more likely to underfill a myopic eye than overfill it. But it can be tricky because some of these myopes have pigmentary dispersion, so they have these pressure specs post-op. And so you can end up in this limbo as you start doing these cases of certain decision making. But I would say you're much more likely to underfill and overfill because it's actually really difficult to get a full fluid air exchange. And unless you sit there for a long time, especially because you're usually doing that at the nerve and the low point isn't the nerve, it's at the fovea. And again, some people will drain at the hole if there's a hole, but I think a lot of us don't like to go there and dig into it because you can't necessarily see on the other side of your soft tip or cutter when you're doing that. And I think the second part of it is just understanding that with the staphyloma, oil has its pros and cons, but it doesn't really support the staphyloma super well because it doesn't fill that space the same way that gas does. Gas does a much better job because it doesn't have that same surface tension of filling empty space and providing some surface tension and tamponade. Oil kind of wants to stay together. And so if you have an underfill of oil, which you inevitably do, if you have a big staphyloma, unless they're perfectly positioned face down, that's where I think, I'm not a big face down positioner, but for these high myopes, it gets really, really important regardless of tamponade. But especially if you use oil, you're not going to end up supporting the area you want to support if they're not strictly face down. So that's another thing to keep in mind.
Jay, I was curious, who uses macular buckles? Because like I haven't, you know, in the place I've trained, nobody really uses them. So I was just wondering.
It's like a philosophical question. If no one puts a macular buckle on, I feel like we always talk about it, but no one does it. I will say this, and I don't want to speak. I'm sure there are people in the United States who are doing it. I know there are some folks in San Francisco that do it. That's always the city that comes up. I don't know why, but people always say there's a couple people in San Francisco at UCSF who do some macular buckling. But macular buckles are a big thing in Europe. They're a huge thing if you go to Asia, you know, because of the myopia pandemic. And then also I've seen people from Egypt talk about macular buckling as well. I have personally never put one on. I don't think anyone on this call has put one on. I've always thought it's an interesting concept. I just think that the one thing that I always think about, and I believe that you can do anything in a really, really amazing way, but I try to think that in my average surgeon's hands, like how that would go, you're dealing with a situation where the sclera is thin and pathologic to begin with, and now you have to secure something there. And so I think obviously if you did it perfectly, it'd be great.
Yeah.
But if you went, it's easier to go deep in that scenario than in another scenario, I feel. But I do think that's not to say it can't work. I mean, Mari, what's your experience? I mean, have you ever seen or done one, or is this something again that comes up?
I've never seen one and I've never done one. So, and for the same reasons you're saying, you know, like a hemorrhage, like just think about all those things that could happen, you know, perf, like, you know, I don't think I'm inclined to do one in my clinic. I'll probably refer these patients to a tertiary center probably if I'm ever thinking of one.
Yeah, I went back June of 2018. It's been 5 years ago. Marco Mura came on the podcast for episode 111. He talked about macular buckling. So if anyone wants to listen to that, I was listening to that. That was a good listen. It clearly didn't inspire me to do any, but he was very educational. But I my thing with that, if anyone's listening, I think if you're going to do that, I would probably try to at least go and see someone do it in person. Unless you're super talented, I think it'd be really tough to just like watch a video and just be like, I'm going to go do a macular buckle tomorrow. I mean, there were some talented people out there. Let's end with this article. So there's this article about advances in training for vitreoretinal surgery in the digital era by Jonathan Lin, John Miller, and Demetrios Vavas, with subtitle New Options Continue to Enhance Learning. So they talk about different things that are available. And I guess they kind of break these surgical tools into 4 or 5 sections, right? So there's surgical simulators like the IC and other simulators. There's online surgical videos, right? We've just talked about that. There's platforms for visualization that allow for like heads up display, or bionics, which is kind of the platform that's like the head mounted display. And then you have the ability to stream your surgeries and have people mentor your surgeries, observe. And then you have meeting platforms. And they talk a little bit about like the metaverse. There's been some discussion of doing teaching and things in the metaverse. And I would say that I like the thing that they said at the end, Mari. They said there's no replacement for in-person learning, but these things are all very, very helpful as adjuncts. And I think that's the only thing I would say as a caution, is I think that the point I was just making, I think that all these things, and again, maybe it will change for our kids. And, you know, Mari, you have kids, and I'm sure the way they interact with each other is becoming more and more digital every day. I do think, though, and this is my bias from a human perspective, there is a tremendous value, whether it's in-person meetings, in-person observation. There's just certain networking and the engagement of all 5 senses that you don't get in a virtual platform. And I think that's been part of the limiting factor for people who have been trying to push some of these things. I think people have some Zoom fatigue. I don't know if there's metaverse fatigue, but I think that that's why it hasn't. That's why I think there's a lot of skepticism about sort of being a replacement. And I think it's important for us to always sort of think of these things as adjuncts and not lose sight of the fact that it's important to see each other in person, not only for practice meetings on a smaller level, but for national meetings and also for educational courses.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, just like very small little things that I think can become big. You know, just in a Zoom meeting, you're not looking at people in the eye, right? You're looking, if you want people to look at you, you look at the camera. And if you look at people, then you're not really looking at their eyes, right? And that really, that feedback, it's how humans interact. And you draw a lot of communication just based on, you know, facial expression and things like that. And you're not going to get that, I don't think, in a virtual setting anytime soon. Maybe the metaverse will, you know, surprise me in 10 or 15 years and I'll be saying something totally different. But at least with the current virtual settings, I think that, you know, they're not going to replace human to human contact anytime soon. And what you can learn from these other cues that you don't get in a virtual setting.
I mean, you don't have to get too personal, but what's your philosophy as a parent, like in terms of like the next generation, in terms of like, this is getting a little off of medicine, but I think about it in terms of education. Like, I feel like I talk to my friends who have kids and we're school age, a lot more of the education is becoming digital. So it's like, you have to teach your kids to be digitally literate. They have to be invested in technology, but I think it's such a slippery slope in terms of getting immersed. So like, how do you handle that? Especially when, you know, you're a physician and you think about like a vulnerable population where every sort of thing they take in is sort of magnified compared to an adult.
Yeah. So I'm very, very mindful of these things. My kids have very strict, times when they can use electronic devices. You know, they were not allowed to use any electronic or watch any TV until they were 3 years old. And now, you know, my daughter started, kindergarten, and they were like, oh, she needs an iPad. And I was like, oh, she's never seen an iPad before. So I'm pretty mindful about that stuff. You know, now I let them watch, you know, a movie on the weekends, a couple of times a week, something like that. But you're not going to see my kids in a restaurant looking at the phone or a TV or the iPad. So they look a lot of books and they play outside and play with each other. They'll get that later on.
Josh, sounds like your fellowship. We let you watch a movie every once in a while on the weekends. If you're cases. What are your thoughts on like the technology aspect or anything here you wanted to highlight from this article? Like, are you not a fan? Like, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I agree with Mari completely that this is not going to replace in-person learning and interaction. It's certainly not going to teach anyone surgery, right? There's no way to teach surgery other than to be in an eye and do it. So you can watch videos and those things are helpful, and you can maybe someday be in some sort of virtual reality meeting where they're showing surgical videos in 3D, and I'm sure that will help augment learning. But those are things to kind of teach new techniques or new approaches or new procedures for people who already have that fundamental skill set. So in terms of how this relates to training fellows, I mean, none of this stuff is remotely close to actually being in an eye and operating. That said, I mean, there are advantages, I think, to some of this, the virtual stuff that's coming our way. I mean, just thinking about advantages of a virtual meeting or like a metaverse meeting is, you know, if you're a fellow and you're on call, so you can't leave your city, or the cost is prohibitive, or, you know, in-person meetings have a finite amount of space that they can actually use to accommodate people. So all of those things can be circumvented in some sort of metaverse meeting. So I don't think it's pointless necessarily, but I also don't think it's going to replace the meetings that we already have. And most importantly, it's not going to teach surgery. And the other thing they talk about is, you know, surgical simulators, and those are more meant to actually teach surgery. And, you know, I didn't use any sort of vitrectomy simulator in fellowship, but in residency, I used the IC, and I think it was helpful in terms of getting used to seeing my hand under a microscope and that kind of thing. But I did not feel like it was really comparable to even really doing a cataract procedure. I didn't even find it that useful.
Yeah, it goes back, Leanna. I mean, we've talked about this before. Even just like when you're in training, you get so much more. To Josh's point, you can learn a lot by passive learning or doing simulators, but I feel like you get more out of those things once you've already started operating. Like, it's weird. Like it's like the double-edged sword. Ironically, it's more useful to watch someone else operate after you've already operated, or it's more useful maybe to go back to the simulator after you've done something, because you can always visualize, be better. There's really no simulator yet that completely replicates what you would be like to be in an eye and all the unexpected things that can happen.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, one of the things they talked about in the paper was like the feedback that you get from actually doing surgery, which, you know, can really not be replicated by a simulator. And in residency, we had to do the IC prior to going to the OR. So I did it. I feel like being, you know, in the eye felt completely different, but I don't know what it would have been like if I hadn't done IC. I don't really think it was that helpful either. I guess, like Josh said, it kind of helps you just orientation wise, like, you know, knowing that you're not really moving your hands that much to make the movements inside the eye, but actually doing the surgery was, you know, completely different. And in terms of like the videos and stuff online, I think they're extremely helpful, but also, like you said, once you've actually done the surgery yourself, then you actually really appreciate everything they're doing in the video. But if you haven't really had the opportunity to do that yourself, it's, you know, it doesn't really mean that much. But I think that it is really helpful, and it's really nice, you know, what they've done, especially with the VRS surgery online book, where they have this free online resource. That's, it's nice to have that, you know, as a worldwide resource for people in other countries who may not have access to everything that we do, to see, you know, all these things and to see what other people are doing, you know, in other countries. So I think it's really nice for that. And I think it's nice to have that shared knowledge, but certainly doesn't replace doing it on your own. And in terms of the metaverse, I mean, I think it was Wall Street Journal who had an episode on their podcast about like the concerts on metaverse, how it's not really like, you don't really see people flocking to like metaverse concerts, because really, like, the human, regardless of the generation, you know, we're, as people are wired to kind of need human contact, and we like having human contact. So, I mean, unless humans, I guess, fundamentally change, I don't think it can replace it. And I think being in person just has so much more meaning than, you know, doing it online. But you know, like Josh said, there's certain circumstances and it's really helpful to have that. Or, you know, who knows if we have another pandemic or other natural disasters, you know, things that would, doing an in-person meeting would be really helpful.
We already talked about drug shortages. We talked about problems. Well, yeah, you're right, though. It's access issues too. I mean, with the argument, anyone who listens to things are being made, that access issue is real. Like, if you're in a country or a situation where you can't go to that meeting economically, or you can't afford it, it's way better than having nothing to have an educational resource. But the metaverse concert is interesting. And that's why I was asking Mari about her kids, because I feel the same way, but I think there might be I worry about generational groupthink, where our whole generation grew up a certain way and thinks a certain way about what human interaction looks like, but that won't be what people view human interaction as is 50 or 20 or 25 years as those kids grow up to be adults. I also, again, my bias coming from my place is I think neurochemically, it's not the same sort of reward system and it's not the same sort of hormonal and metabolic response to those sort of interactions. It doesn't mean they can't be meaningful or fruitful, but I do think that one of the reasons there's a little bit of a culture of emptiness going way metaphysical beyond retina is I don't think you get the same sort of reward from those interactions. And I don't think human beings have evolved as fast as the technology. So we are still very much neurochemically the same people who were in small tribes and villages thousands of years ago. Yet we have this advanced technology that lets you kind of replicate any interaction in a digital space, but it's not exactly the same. So my worry, I actually think that people will start doing it. I just worry people aren't going to be as happy and they won't know why. So that will be an interesting question. I was trying to end on a positive note. I kind of just totally. All right. That's Retinal Position, July 2023. Lediana Beduni, Josh Uhr, Mario Rodriguez. Thanks so much for joining me for this one. And I hope to see you guys soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Many thanks to our team for joining us for today's episode. Listeners, remember you can find 397 episodes sorted by category on our website, retinapodcast.com. That's retinapodcast.com. Remember, you can find them all archived there for your listening pleasure. We are on Twitter and on Facebook. On Twitter, we are at retinapodcast, and you can contact us either by clicking on the contact us link on the website or emailing me directly at retinapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks to our whole production team, that includes Dr. Justin Ma, Louis Kai, Angela Chang, and Mike Benicasa. Listeners, thank you for what you do on a daily basis, the articles you read and publish, the patients you take care of, and the conversations you inspire here each week. This is Jay Schreeder, signing off.
Good feeling.
This is straight from the cutter's mouth.